Well, hello again there, folks, and welcome once again to Classic Movies. Am I coming through okay in the chat there? Can somebody give me a one if you can hear me okay in the chat? It should be all right. Back again. This is stream number, Classic Movies number 50. There we are. All right, wonderful. Thanks a lot there in the chat. Classic Movies 50. We've got a bit of a Christmassy one. And I think we're going to have a little bit of a heated discussion on this one. But people who followed me for a long time may recall that I did a kind of searing indictment of this on my original blog way back when. And I've had a bit of a rethink, but Endeavor is going to point out that it's really subversive, I think. But whatever the case, hello, Endeavor. How are you doing? Welcome back again.
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm fine. I'll tell you what, I'm cold. Like, I was doing a bit of gardening earlier. I was doing some work in the garden, and I came in. I think it's about like 2-3 degrees, and I just couldn't get warm. And I really, that's when you know when you're getting old, is that you just can't get warm anymore. The cold. Like the dampness, it's as if even your blood's cooled. Everything's cooled in your body, and all you want to do is wrap yourself up in a blanket. That's just age creeping up on you. But I've got me fancy woolly cardigan on and everything. So yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready for it. I think this is a cozy movie. I like this movie, but I also understand why opinion on it is divided, and I'm sure we're going to get into all of that. What was your like first impressions of Trading Places? Was it the first time you'd seen it?
Yeah, actually, it was the first time I had seen the movie. I had read that blog post which you wrote several years ago, but I had never actually seen the movie. So watching it for the stream was the first time I had seen it. But I will say that it was a funny 1980s movie. It was a lot more. It was a lot more fun than anything that's made these days. But I will say that I do think it is one of the most anti-white movies I've ever seen. I mean, at least that I've seen recently, because I mean, many of the themes are extremely subversive. And well, I think we might as well just point it out right away that the director was Jewish, the guys who wrote it were Jewish, the producers were Jewish, which I mean, might come as no surprise that it's from Hollywood, but I mean, I saw the themes which you pointed out in the original blog post back in the day. So, I mean, that was kind of my interpretation of it. It's definitely a pleasant movie to watch. It was definitely funny and it was enjoyable. But I mean, you can see those themes laced into the movie, and well, the implication is pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, we will have to tread carefully here because I'm on a watch list and YouTube have been banning channels again recently. And on top of that, when you kind of poke into some of the issues with this movie, and I mean, there's literally like a hard N-word said towards the end. It's a bit of a minefield. So we'll just bear in mind in the chat, we are where we are. I don't have free speech at any rate. So you'll just have to bear with us as we delicately kind of tiptoe across some of the minefields that will come up in this little stream that we're going to do. But I think it's from the kind of it's, I think it's kick started, or it's kind of at the beginning of what you can think of as like a golden era, especially with a director, John Landis. It's something of a golden era of 80s comedies. And this is right in the middle of it all. You can go on later where some of them were a bit more family friendly than what this one is. I mean, it's quite surprising the language that's in it for a comedy, you know, and like the boobs and stuff these days is something that you're surprised to see when you look back at it. But for anybody who doesn't know the gist of it, it's set in Philadelphia. That caught me out as well. I thought I hadn't watched it for years, and I thought it was all in New York, but it's actually in Philadelphia. And it features Louis Winthorpe III, played by Dan Aykroyd, and he is the quintessential WASP, they're in trading and commodities and stock exchanges and all the rest of it. And he's obviously, he's working for these two old rich brothers, the Dukes, Randolph and Mortimer. And they're living the high life. They're high on the hog, and they're part of this kind of East Coast aristocracy almost in America of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And they are what Tom Wolfe calls these masters of the universe in his book, Bonfire of the Vanities, I think it is, or Man in Full. But that's kind of like what it is. If you've read like Bonfire of the Vanities, we're kind of in that world, though that's set in New York. So we're in the high-flying wasp world of blue bloods in America. And they decide to have the two Duke brothers, have a kind of ongoing debate centered basically on the nature versus nurture sort of argument, which, you know, it rages on to this day, especially in America. And you can see by the demographics involved, the kind of where they're kind of nodding towards here. So they destroy Winthorpe's life. They set it up with their sneaky private detective, Clarence Beeks. And they frame him for dealing drugs or stealing marked dollar bills from the club that they're all in. And then on the other hand, you see Eddie Murphy in what was one of his earlier roles. He did 48 hours before this, but I think that hadn't come out yet. But they basically bet on Eddie Murphy being big, and it paid off because he was, mainly on the back of this, because it's very well written. And then they basically lift up Eddie Murphy and put him into Dan Aykroyd's Louis Winthorpe's position. So it's a lot of it as well is that it's like the old Prince and the Pauper. It's basically a retelling of the Prince and the Pauper for 1980s America. And the two of them go off on their own arcs. I mean, I think there's some hilarious stuff in it, like, but we'll get into all of that. But the two of them go off on their two arcs where Winthorpe's life goes down the tubes and Billy Ray Valentine's Eddie Murphy's life, he actually gets put in his position. So for the first time, he's granted status and luxury and money and, like a promising career and all of the rest of it. And the idea is to say, well, if it is just the material conditions and not blood and ancestry and all of that, then there's no reason. Then these two people should be and actually are totally interchangeable. And so this is where the main sort of tension of the film is. Though, to be fair, they do like rig the game in both cases. except with Eddie Murphy's, it's like his street smarts get him. Because at first glance, you think, well, how could he possibly understand commodities is part of the thing here? But, you know, he's literally like a little petty thief on the streets, pretending to be a Vietnam vet. And, you know, he does it because it's all about betting. It's like he's using his street smarts to succeed in business, is what they're trying to say. On the other hand, Dan Aykroyd, he's got a tough lesson in the harsh realities of the world, is the framing, where now he's understanding how like difficult it is for poor people, people who are, like to use the word now, underprivileged, and all of the rest of it. And then you get Jamie Lee Curtis comes in as a prostitute who becomes Dan Aykroyd's kind of squeeze. And then there's Denon Elliott as the butler. And then all of this kind of, all of these underdogs team together to rig the stock market basically in their favor and outdo the Dukes. That's a kind of basic outline we can get in. And somebody says in the chat, you guys are just a couple of bookies. Yeah, it's basically just, that's what he's doing. That's their way to get around that problem of how would he possibly understand like the world of commodities trading and stocks and all of that. It's that he's using his street smarts. So I'll pass it over to you, Endeavor.
Well, I mean, the wager of nature versus nurture. I mean, this is something which we're dealing with today in the real world, this idea that what is it that determines somebody's competency or lack thereof? Is it their ancestry, or is it their the environment which they were raised in, or what combination of the two? Which one is more influential? And the reigning orthodoxy in the West today is that it's all about environment. So the reason that some guy from Somalia is, has an IQ of 70 and isn't able to make it in Western countries the same way that a white European is able to, it's because he was raised in a third world country and he wasn't given the education and that if we brought him to the West and gave him the education and didn't discriminate against him, he'd be just as successful as any Norwegian person. He'd be just as likely to become a successful neurosurgeon. Now, this is the basis for the entire social policy of the West. And I don't think I don't think anyone listening to the stream needs to be red-pilled that obviously that's ridiculous. But this is the crux of the movie. And then the side that they come down on is that apparently this Billy Ray Valentine, so Eddie Murphy's character, he's able to be just as successful as Dan Aykroyd's Harvard. So like the black guy who lives on the street is just as successful as Dan Aykroyd's Harvard educated WASP American is in the world of high finance. I mean, I know that they give like some kind of explanation, but it really just makes no sense. Like the idea that people in commodities trading wouldn't get that people would buy things differently during the holidays. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, I completely missed that part of the movie altogether. It just seemed like he just became a genius the second they put him into this big house. And I mean, this is the idea that's advanced by leftists and by liberals today that, well, if we just gave Africans or whoever it is, other groups, just the same conditions, then they would be just as successful, which is obviously not the case. But I mean, the movies, it pushes this narrative quite hard. And then likewise, they say that Dan Aykroyd becomes a criminal would-be killer, but just by taking away his money, which I also think is ridiculous because, I mean, you know, I've been poor. I've been tight for cash in my life before, but I've never considered robbing or murdering anybody. But then what you see later in the movie is that when the nurture side wins the debate, even though I think that it would, that is ridiculous, it wouldn't work like that in real life. The Duke brothers then say that they still don't want Eddie Murphy working for them, even though he's making them tons of money. They still don't want him working for them because he's black and for no other reason. And I mean, this is just the caricature that every libtard has in their mind about race in America, but now also in Britain, Canada, all the entire Western world, that there is just this vast conspiracy theory that, well, if black people were given just the same opportunity and there were no discrimination and they were given education, they'd be just as successful. But there's this innate conspiracy theory among whites. It's what they call institutional racism, that they just are conspiring to keep them out of success because they're racist and because they like to get off on sadism. So that's pretty much the message that the movie is advancing now. The movie does it in a clever way. It's funny, it's entertaining, but let's not forget that this is basically the foundation of the libtard view of the world and the view of issues like race today. And well, you know, you see with stuff like this being produced, then 20, 30 years later, you get, well, not even 20, 30 years later, it was already in the works by then, but you get the Great Awakening, you get white privilege theory, and well, you know, it all comes from somewhere.
So if you wanted a half, let's like grab the nettle then. So if you wanted to say this is a absolutely subversive, like, you know, going back on the blog that I did about this years ago, it's like an attack on WASP America and all of the rest of it. Like the point that I made years ago on this was that the story really is the story of the white man, the successful sort of upper class white man atoning for his sort of sins of institutionalized racism or whatever, if you wanted to look at it from a leftist perspective. And so what you find is that over the course, it's a morality tale, but it's one in which he has to learn to give up all of his power, his status. And then he also has to learn that the people below him are actually his allies. And that's exactly how it goes. And if you wanted to flick forward to this part of the film, which I thought is much closer to the end, you see this kind of coalition of, you know, obviously Eddie Murphy, who's black, then you've got the prostitute, and then you've even got this kind of Denham Elliot gets dressed up as like a drunken Irish priest. And so the Wasp is now in amongst this coalition. But really, the reason why I think I'm not too sure, like, I get it, and it's there's some good laughs in it. But the real, you know that meme that where it's got like a it looks like Rupert Murdoch, and he's pointing to somebody and he's saying he's trying to steal your cookie, and you've got like a white man and a black man on each side of the table. It's kind of like that, because for most of the film, Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd, they both know that something's weird's going on. There's, as Eddie Murphy says, there's some weird shit going on. They feel like there's something off, and it's because the whole game has been rigged by Duke and Duke. And so there's an element of it where, for most of the movie, they, like the two main protagonists, the two main characters, they don't know that they're being manipulated by the two Dukes. And so there's this kind of sort of leftist slant to it where, you know, where here you are like bickering amongst each other. You're bickering because they're racist, or you're bickering because, and all of the while, it's the elites who are benefiting from this. And it's the elites who've got you fighting against each other. And that's kind of an element to it as well. But the main argument, if you wanted to say the real kind of, it's almost as if it's like that white privilege thing. It's almost as if Dan Aykroyd had to check his privilege in order to be a fully functioning part of society. But I think that's kind of offset by the fact that they're both being manipulated by the elites, you know?
I mean, that's from a kind of a different take on it, like from a leftist perspective. But even that one, I would kind of think as subversive, because I think I like when this argument's brought up today. So what libtards often say today is that, well, when you're angry about immigration, well, it's actually the elites that are causing your problems, and it's because you can't afford rent or something like that. But of course, they'll never accept the fact that immigration is why people can't afford rent. It's the primary reason. I mean, it's still kind of a subversive, it's still a subversive message, because the implication is that even if we don't look at the ethnic component, which I want to get into later, because I think that's absolutely there, but if we just don't look at it at the ethnic component, so we can ignore them as being WASP. Let's just say they're the rich. Well, I mean, the leftist narrative is that, well, it'll be all the different multiracial coalition of working class, of the working class proletariat, overthrowing the rich and bringing about the workers' utopia, the kind of just classical Marxism. But I mean, that's just incorrect as well, because this is like no one other than whites are encouraged to actually think of it in this way. When you look at at black identity politics, you look at all these other ethnic lobbies. Like, we have this big problem in Canada with both Hindu and Sikh ethnic lobbies. None of them are egalitarian. None of them are saying that, well, we need to work together to overthrow the rich. It's always just what's good for their group. So it's kind of selling this kind of, it's selling this fake notion to the character from the perspective of Dan Aykroyd's character, selling this fake notion that, well, you need to side with the underclass against the rich, and then you'll get the workers' utopia, which is obviously not going to happen. But then secondly, I mean, they have the theme of classical Marxism, but there's kind of this bait and switch, because at the end of the movie, when Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd team up against the Duke brothers, they don't liberate the poor or anything like that. The movie just ends with them on some exclusive island in somewhere in the Caribbean on yachts with martinis and everything like that. So they just make themselves rich. So they don't liberate the poor. They just transfer the wealth from the Duke brothers to themselves. And I mean, I think that this is also kind of emblematic, keeping in mind who the people who made the movie and their ethnic background. Keeping that in mind, well, in the early 20th century, this group pushed Marxism. So when you look at something like the Russian Revolution, the failed revolutions in Hungary, Bavaria, you look at the communist parties in countries like the United States and Canada, well, this group was overwhelmingly vastly overrepresented in the leadership of these movements. But then, you know, come mid to late 20th century, once they already had become wealthy, once they had taken over basically the American establishment by that point, well, they didn't push Marxism anymore. So once they had the money for themselves, it was just, well, we're going to rule in our own interest. So it's kind of this transfer. It's not about liberating the poor. It's just transferring transferring the power from one group, this being the WASPs, to the movie showing the kind of the multiracial coalition, when in reality you can kind of think of, well, the people making the movie. So I mean, that's how I'd answer the issue of the Marxism question.
Yeah, I mean, our friend Closenton just replied to me before, and he said that it shocked me that this was in Philadelphia, because I just think of Philadelphia. I knew from the Rocky movies, but my impression of Philadelphia was that it was just a total dump. And what's interesting, what Closenton sort of pointed out, who knows about these things, I've got the Wikipedia article up here, is that the old Philadelphians, also called proper Philadelphians or perennial Philadelphians, are the first families of Philadelphia, that class of Pennsylvanians who claim hereditary and cultural descent mainly from England, also from Ulster, Wales, and even Germany, and who founded the city of Philadelphia. They settled the state of Pennsylvania. They are considered part of the historic core of the East Coast establishment, along with other wealthy families such as Boston Brahmins of Boston and the 400 of New York City. These families were influential in the development and leadership of arts, culture, science, medicine, law, politics, industry, and trade in the United States. They were almost exclusively white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and most belonged to the Episcopal Church, I've probably pronounced that wrong, and Quakerism. And what you're talking about here is an elite, like in a genuine sense, it's an elite class that sort of went up and down the East Coast of America and would have been connected in New York. And it just so happens in this movie, we're looking at the, in particular in Philadelphia. But where this gets spicy is that we know that to a large or small degree, how can I put this delicately? Some people have the opinion that this elite lost out to a more Semitic elite. I'll put it like that. And that in the end, they were displaced from power by that group in the sort of elite institutions of America. And this is turning into a very serious stream for like a lighthearted comedy movie. But it does have to be addressed. You can't just pretend it's not the case, because it's the same group who made this movie. And when you look at where we are now, I should have got a better photo of it. But where the Dukes are standing now is in, what would you call it, like a grand hall or something, where they all meet, like a kind of lodge or something. And they're all in there, and Winthorpe is just about to get called out. And so it's that kind of old thing where they wouldn't let us into the country clubs, you know. And if you're a group who doesn't like slights, and if you're a group who has been barred entry into these elite institutions and social networks, you're going to harbour this seething resentment against them. I mean, look, to a certain extent, you can see it today with the kind of the tension between them and Tucker Carlson, like today in the news cycle and on the podcast net scene, you've got this same sort of thing playing out again. But in Trading Places, it's kind of, it takes on a new kind of life when you realize that they've then made this, wrote the script, made the movie in their own institution. So it is like, for all that I think it's a kind of fun film, it's hard to get around the fact that there's an element of gloating and nastiness embedded within it when you look at it in its entirety from a sort of meta perspective.
Because like one thing that I notice is it's not even just the issue that they're white. It's also that it just seems like the creators of the movie, and we've already mentioned who they are, it just seems like they have this burning hatred for WASP America. Because I don't know if you caught this during the movie, but Philadelphia, for example, is an extremely important city historically in the United States. I believe the Continental Congress was there originally, and that's where the Liberty Bell is. It's known as the City of the Liberty Bell and everything like that. So it's a historically important city in the United States, and they put all of these kind of WASP American cultural markers. So you can see in this picture on the screen, there's just like a ridiculous amount of portraits on the wall of white men from the 19th and 18th centuries. All of the WASP elites, they all live in these classical architecture houses. All their houses are covered with wood paneling. And what this kind of does, at least the impression of that I got from the movie, or like, for example, it was called the Heritage Club. The club that they were part of was called the Heritage Club. It said it was founded in 1776. And they just really drive it home. The impression that I got is that you're supposed to associate everything, you know, not only just white people in general, but WASP America, its history, its aesthetics, its culture, all that is supposed to be kind of associated with this, with snobbishness, cruelty. It's supposed to be shallow, stupid, and, well, cartoonishly racist. Like, for example, you'll even see that there are scenes where they have that big meeting with the ridiculous amount of paintings on the wall. All the servants there are black, and they're all like dusting. They're all like dusting the perfect like oak chairs and things like that. I mean, it's really kind of over the top. So they really drive that. They take kind of the WASP aesthetic, but then like they take it to like an absolutely ridiculous degree. It's exaggerated extremely to an extreme degree. And I think like the implication I got out of it is that basically that entire version of America is just illegitimate, and that it's associated with elitism and oppression and racism. So I got the impression that, you know, you mentioned the whole country club issue, that it's kind of like them, you know, being gloating over the fact that, you know, the change had taken place, because this other group had rose to power in the 1960s. By the 1980s, they were already the most powerful group in the United States, and their power was just taking off at that point. But they're a group that's extremely vengeful and vindictive. And, you know, I mean, I think that you get, I mean, at least the director of the movie, that I get the impression that they're still angry about not being allowed in the country club back in, you know, 1925 or something like that.
I mean, just to sort of draw this out a little bit, I mean, Closeton's in the chat, and he's saying, well, they intermarried and a lot of these institutions are still there. I'm sure the institutions are like there, but they're probably like these conservative cook sort of Zio shill things, which the online right and Tucker Carlson and Fuentes is currently going hammer and tongs at. But just to move on from that for a second and look at this, which is on a similar theme, you know, it's hard to like miss that of the three here, leaving aside the sort of the African thing, which would, by the way, would be regarded as racist today. You've also got the kind of blonde Aryan Scandinavian sort of trope. But remember that that's like a kind of cheap prostitute. And then you've also got the trope of, so that there's another kind of target, is the kind of Germanic blonde. But then you've also got the Irish Catholic priest. So it's kind of like a list, you know, there's a certain, there's a certain element to it there that I cannot like not see. But there's another one as well, and it's this. So just to get back to the movie for a second, what happens is Winthorpe, his life goes to hell. He's, you know, he's taken to the drink. He's just like this sort of disheveled, stinking, trampy beast of a thing. And he wants to set up Billy Ray Valentine. He wants to sort of get revenge on him. This is what I was alluding to earlier. And he sneaks into the club, I think it is, or is it the stock exchange or something? And he goes into the office and he's dressed up as Santa Claus, and you see him shoving a salmon down his top. He's very drunk. He's got a gun. He's trying to frame. He's trying to plant drugs and stuff on Eddie Murphy, and he gets caught. I mean, I will say, I have to just find that whole scene where everything goes wrong for him again and again and again. He can't even shoot himself. Like, as a dog, like, pisses on his leg, and then the reins opens up on him. That's funny. I just think it's funny to see like how over the top it is. I'm not going to say it's not, but I can acknowledge how funny some of these moments are in the movie. But I can also say that it is also a trope. This is going back. People used to discuss this a lot more than what they do these days. I mean, Blackpilled would probably still get into this. But if you look at a lot of the movies in Hollywood, especially in the 1980s, during this time, this era, you'll notice that the Santa Claus would appear in movies, or somebody dressed as Santa Claus, but it would be like utterly defiled. It would be utterly kind of besmirched. And there was a movie which was more recent called Bad Santa, which I never watched. And it's all to sort of deconstruct and demythologize Santa Claus and the Christmas spirit. So what you have here is, by this point in the movie, Dan Aykroyd is just this kind of stinking, suicidal, psycho bum. And he's just looks disgusting in Santa Claus. And he's eaten this salmon on like a bus, and he's covered in like piss, and it's just this horrible, you know, the beard's all matted and dirty, and it reminds me of Gremlins. We did Gremlins for the Christmas movie a year or two back, but there's that story in Gremlins as well, when the girl tells a story about how she hates Christmas. And it's because her father tried to surprise the family. He tried to climb down the chimney on Christmas Eve, and he got stuck, and they didn't know where he was. And then his body rotted. And then they realized he was dressed up as Santa, and he died in the chimney, and he was slowly like rotten in the chimney, but they didn't know where he was. So again and again, you'll notice this kind of thing where they just need to drag. It sounds kind of petty. They do want to drag Santa Claus into the mud, because it's more than that. It's that they want to sort of subvert and destroy Christmas itself, the Christmas spirit, the purity of the symbols is then kind of broken apart. And it's again in Trading Places.
Yeah, I can think of a few films like that. I mean, I didn't find that to be the worst element of the film, but you can see that in this one as well. I mean, I can think of the Home Alone scene where the guy is Santa Claus is a he's just kind of like a bum with a rundown car. But I mean, Home Alone wasn't made by this, but you know, that kind of person. And I kind of just thought it was a bit more funny. Now, this movie's a bit darker and a lot more adult than something like Home Alone. But I mean, they have that element in there. I didn't think it was too bad in this one. I mean, I know that he kind of becomes this dysfunctional homeless guy living with a prostitute who's unable to get a job or anything. I mean, the other thing to point out is with Christmas movies is that they don't have Jesus in any of them. That this happened a bit earlier, but Blackpill did something on this a few years ago, that all the Christmas songs, they never mention Jesus, and well, you know, who are they written by? But I don't know. I mean, I didn't think that. I didn't think it was the worst element to the film, but it is something that you do see in you do see that in Hollywood a bit. I thought that the Gremlins one was a lot worse, like than this one. I mean, this one I can kind of laugh at. That scene in Gremlins, I just thought I found that like unpleasant, you know?
Yeah, I mean, looking at the other side of the equation, though, when you've got this sort of when you follow Eddie Murphy's arc. This is why I think there's a little bit more balance. This is why I was like, yeah, okay, I get it. I get the subversion and all of that. But when you look at the sort of the pauper side of it, if you think of it like the prince and the pauper side of it, because they've racialized it and made Eddie Murphy black, that means that it's surprisingly sort of gritty, I feel. When anybody, because there's quite a few people, like both of them end up in jail a couple of times in this movie, but all of the people in the police stations are not all of them. Like there's a scene with Dan Aykroyd's girlfriend who's in the process of getting sick and tired of him and going to dump him. And then she's getting leered at by a couple of like weird white fellas. But even that's kind of funny. But in the jail cells and whatnot, it's really quite ethnic. I wouldn't say it's black. I saw when Eddie Murphy's in the jail cell and he's pretending that he can do kung fu, I saw Gustav Fring from Breaking Bad as like a young punk, like a really young man in this, which I was quite surprised to catch that one. But you do get the impression, like from today, the way black people are portrayed in this would be problematic, I think, because they didn't mix it up like that. It's very clear that high society is white, low society is black. And there's a scene when Eddie Murphy takes over his house, beautiful house, townhouse. And he invites in lots of people. Now it is a mixture of prostitutes and druggies and pimps and all of this. But what happens is he tells them all to get lost. But what you see is that he's beginning to care about his belongings. That he's all of a sudden when he goes in there, which is like literally just like a day or two beforehand, and he's just picking everything up in his pockets and going to rob the place blind for everything that he can get. But then 2 days later, because he's used to the status, because he's now a member of the club, if you like, although so he thinks, then he starts to like really worry and get concerned that they're putting joints out on his carpet or that they're in his bed or they're dropping food everywhere. And it's as if that now the point that the writers are making there is that now that he's got status, he's part of the club, then he too will be a bit of a snob and he'll turn on the people of his own environment. In the same way that when Dan Aykroyd goes into the sports club and he sees all of his friends, his WASP kind of peers, they just want nothing to do with them. They just turn their backs and cast them out straight away, which in reality, like let's just take both of those situations because I do think it's interesting. If you were to apply that in real world, do you think that Eddie Murphy would change his way within 2 days?
No, because you can even see examples of this. Like, look at all these athletes. Like, look at NFL players and NBA players, and how many of them go bankrupt. And well, you can just look at the demographic breakdown of players in the NFL and NBA. And then when you contrast that with the NHL, which is almost entirely white, very few of them go bankrupt. So, no, I don't think that just handing Eddie Murphy a bunch of money would mean that he would actually care about his belongings that he's just been handed. I think he'd be throwing parties like that until he went bankrupt.
And on the other hand, do you think that all, like, the immediate thing that happens basically is that Dan Aykroyd gets dumped by his fiancée, Penelope. None of his friends will help him out. They all just want him to get lost straight away because he's dressed up like a bum. Again, I don't think that would actually happen either, to be honest. I think he would get a handout.
Oh, no, I don't think it would happen either. For example, I have one family member who, not that I want to get into like finance or anything, but this person, their net worth is probably 1,000 times higher than mine. I know it's not like a close family member. I'm not inheriting any of that stuff, but none of them are like, oh, you dirty, poor, homeless bum. I mean, I'm not homeless or anything, but the point is that like they don't treat you, they don't really treat you badly because you're in a lower socioeconomic class than them, even because you're in the same family. I mean, it just seems kind of cartoonish and just plays into a lot of these like both Marxian but then also anti-white leftist tropes, which there's a reason that leftists believe stuff like this, because it's these kind of cartoonish ideas are pushed within the media and education. But I just don't feel like it works like that in reality.
Yeah, I don't know that. It is very convenient. I meant to look it up. Like the book, The Prince and the Pauper, has slight elements of that, but not. The problem here is that because they've got into the racial side of it, you bring in a whole different dynamic, especially because where we are now, and especially because it's in America. But in the same story in The Prince of the Pauper, there's elements of that, but it's somehow not as bad. Because they're trying to make it a morality tale, which I get. But when it gets very complicated, when you bring in all of the sort of the racial stuff, I find that, you know.
But then you also just point out at the end that they just make themselves rich. They just line their own pockets and then they just become the new aristocracy, I guess, so to say. They don't actually ever liberate the poor. So the ending scene is just with them on yachts in the Caribbean.
I do think that's funny. There's something Eddie Murphy, at this point, Eddie Murphy seemed like a really fresh talent. And when he's introduced and he's on that little sort of board thing with the wheels on, pretend he's got no legs. And there's an M, and then the policeman, like, he basically pretends that he's been he's a Vietnam vet and that he got blinded. And it's all nonsense, of course. But the policeman asks him, I was in Nam as well. Where did you serve? And Eddie Murphy's like, dong bang dong or dong dong bang. it's just sort of like quing ding dong, and he's just like obviously making it up. It's obviously just bullshit. But I think it's funny because it's kind of it's like this sort of a postmodern thing where they're acknowledging that there's already been movies out about Vietnam at this time, and they're kind of making jokes about it. It's like nothing is sacred in this, you know. And when it's in 1983, I think. Because people now talk about how all of the culture has been broken apart, everything's deconstructed, you know, and it wasn't always that way. But here you can see, if you go all the way back to 1983, that something like, well, this movie is just all about breaking apart tropes and kind of, you know, dissolving these identities and these holding them up and looking at them at different ways. And that little bit about Vietnam, I think, is interesting because it's as if it knows that the audience are beginning to get a little bit of Vietnam fatigue, that it's become a cliche. It's becoming a cliche in movies how much time people spend like talking about like the Tet Offensive or, you know, the Dong Dang line and all of this kind of thing. And I just think eventually you have to be serious. Eventually you have to be like, where we are now is partly because of this kind of sort of nihilism in the 80s. But you can see just how sort of it is addictive, though. It is funny. It is funny to see the tropes of the society and the culture just being exploded and blown apart. It is kind of funny to see like Santa drunk on a bus and kind of chewing in a salmon. There's no way around it. It is. But the long-term effects of all of this on the culture are absolutely devastating. Do you see what I mean? And it's like you can giggle away at all of the, leaving aside what we were saying, you know, about that group and everything, you can kind of giggle away at, oh, well, let's like lampoon the upper class Protestant whites in America. Let's be clown them and all of this. And it's as if like a lot of the long-term consequences were being set up in these kind of films in the 80s, you know?
I see what you mean. Kind of the sacredifying, what's the correct word? Demystifying of desacralizing of important cultural icons, something like Santa Claus, something like the Vietnam War. I didn't actually even catch that. I actually thought that scene about him pretending to be a Vietnam vet, I thought that was the funniest scene in the movie, to be honest. But I see what you mean. And you can see that with other, you can even see that with what I pointed out earlier with the aesthetics of traditional America. The fact that it was called the Heritage Club, it was founded in 1776. They had all these portraits of these men from the 19th and 18th centuries on the wall. You can see that there's this kind of ridicule being put towards the founding of America, towards the country's heritage. And of course, this is an American movie, but of course, this has been done across the Western world. But then, one thing to also point out, and I know that I'm not saying anything people haven't heard before, but you know, something like Schindler's List came out 10 years later, and that was absolutely not supposed to be comedic. It was supposed to be taken dead seriously, and that what you see is like the icons which they want you to see as sacred, those ones they will protect. So with libtards, they understand that, and then you know the other group as well, but they understand how important certain cultural icons were. So like when people were mocking the idea of George Floyd being this deity back in 2020, many times they were getting fired from their jobs because based on the narrative they were trying to push, that was supposed to be something which you were supposed to see as sacred. Now, I mean, it was ridiculous and moronic, and it's died off because it's stupid and over the top and preachy. But you can see how important cultural icons really are. And then I think that maybe it is kind of this double-edged knife, because a lot of this does make for good comedy. So something like Life of Brian. Now, this was Life of Brian was British. It wasn't made by the tribe or anything. But some people have pointed out that, and Life of Brian is a really funny movie. I enjoy the movie, but I'm not really Christian, but you can kind of see that it kind of ridicules the idea of seeing Jesus Christ as a sacred figure, and that it's hard to take the Bible seriously after having laughed at Life of Brian. I'm not someone who's religious. I mean, I went to church for a few years. I decided, you know, what wasn't resonating with me, but I mean, I have respect for Christianity, but you can kind of see how just this kind of ridicule that it was constantly heaped onto things like Christmas, things like Jesus Christ, and then in this case maybe the Vietnam War. But I mean, that one might be a bit more minor, but you can see how that kind of diminished people's appreciation for these things. Then, you know, years later when they're trying to eliminate all of that, well, then your defenses have kind of been brought down to that kind of cultural attack. When you look on the opposite side, they are absolutely adamant about defending let's say events that supposedly happened during World War II. They want to make that against the law to not see as sacred. So it is something which is a very subversive kind of this nihilism heaped onto important cultural icons.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds us, I've told it before, but that there's a philosophy channel out there called Then and Now, and he did an earlier video about Hitler, and the point that and it got totally demonetized. Now the point was he was making the thing that the mid-century Germans, and in particular Hitler, should not be outside of the realms of deconstruction. It should not be beyond the grasp that he, because what he recognized correctly was that the the Austrian painter was becoming a kind of sign or a symbol for something more. And in our sort of secular age, we don't stand for that anymore. Everything should be looked at in terms of like just realism and materialism. And you can get into the fact that he was this man and he had a psychology. He was just flesh and blood and nothing more than that. And you can analyze his, his psychology, his motives, his incentives and all of the rest of it. But what he noted was that he'd become much more than that, and he'd become this demonic sort of figure, which didn't fit in with the rest of the society. Now, his video, and I think it was called something like Demystifying Hitler or something, but that got demonetized and completely crippled in the algorithm by YouTube, because what had happened is that the algorithm had been is set to detect sort of certain keywords and phrases, and it had detected in his video and in his thumbnail or something that this was an attack on the actual post-war sort of mythology meta-narrative. And so this is what I thought was crazy, because his video asking innocently, he didn't know, he's like a liberal, he genuinely didn't know, he kind of stumbled accidentally into terrain which he didn't really understand, and yet I knew it, and he's like this big brain philosopher and I'm not, and I was like, I know exactly why your video on that with that title got demonetized and blacklisted by YouTube, but you don't, because the truth of it is a kind of top-down mythology for the post-war era. You just don't understand that. You think that he was coming at it from a perspective that everything is fair game, everything can be deconstructed, and I'm like, no, because he'd also say he'd reject the idea that this certain group has got more power, which is what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And it was just the whole, that little sort of saga fascinated me.
Yeah. I mean, I think I saw that video. I think that you mentioned it, I eventually saw it. I think that the point that he made was that a lot of academics today and stuff were trying to explain how the awards that Hitler won during World War I were illegitimate or something like that. They're trying to like say that, well, he was a bad soldier or something like that. But then he pointed out, like, is it possible that he actually fought bravely in the First World War? He was awarded the Iron Cross. He was a quite decorated soldier. And he just asked the question, is it possible that he actually did, like, you know, at least in the context of World War One and from the Germans, is it possible that he was actually just a good soldier? But like that, if I'm remembering the video correctly, what he's pointing out is that like people couldn't accept the idea that he just won the Iron Cross because he did good soldier work. That it must have been some kind of ulterior explanation for it. I think that was the point he made, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, it's quite a few years ago now. I remember the gist of it. And you know, it's just one of those things. But we're getting a little bit off track from trading places. That does tend to happen. That's why I like classic movies, because you do go all over the place. And another thing that we haven't really touched on, which Anglo-Saxon girl was moaning about earlier in the chat, was that this was the era of like Ronald Reagan,
right?
And you can see that. Because this is a recurring theme of classic movies, mainly because of the movies that I pick. And you can see that in this, there is actually a genuine sense of optimism, isn't there? There is, what are we at this point, 3 or 4 years into Reagan? And even the subject matter, the neoliberal economics is coming in. There's a kind of genuine sense of hope, and there's a lightheartedness which just doesn't exist at all in our culture at all. Like, this is the thing. Like, on the one hand, Trading Places is a subversive movie, but on another, it's a kind of affirmation of America and capitalism. It is like you've got freedom, you've got, and it wraps the really clever thing, I think. Is what you see again. You'll see it in Die Hard. You'll see it in Lethal Weapon. Is that it actually does sort of address that America does have these racial issues, which is important as well. So you could have had, for example, Billy Ray's character could have been, I saw somebody mention this as well in the chat, Billy Ray's character could have been somebody from Alabama or somewhere, some kind of, you know, some redneck, something like that, who's down on his luck and all of that. But it would have been like a sort of, then you would have had a proper class dynamic where it would have been the WASP versus the sort of the poor working class whites from out in the sticks kind of dynamic going on. And instead, they've gone firmly for the racial angle. And that's like more interesting, and there's more to talk about with it, I think. But it also does this thing where everything gets folded back into a main kind of meta narrative. Nothing is left outside of it. Because if you did that, if you had it all of the, like both of the main characters being white, for example, it would be as if the sort of the story of the inner city blacks would be kind of left out of the frame. But when you say, actually, we're gonna go directly into that and bring them into the story, you end up with a kind of much more coherent sort of society. In a way, it's like it creates a multicultural mythos, at least in Hollywood, which may be completely out of kilter with the real world. I mean, there's something similar in National Lampoon's as well, where this, we are all part of this America. It's just that there's different groups and they've got their different problems, but we're all in it together. And as a kind of narrative for getting over some of the racial grievances, it does a good job of it. And I'd say it's part of the reason why my generation or the millennials grew up so completely race blind, where you think, well, actually, you know, it's embedded in your psychology that black men are all funny and clever, like Eddie Murphy.
Oh yeah, I mean, this propaganda is much more effective than something like the stuff we see today, like something like Get Out, which is just cartoonish, and you know, you can easily see through it. I mean, it's not reflective of, and it's not reflective of reality or anything like that. With this one, with something like Trading Places, something like Die Hard, or something like the Rocky movies, they kind of, again, it's from the perspective of America, but America influenced the entire Western world. It gives you the idea that the multiracial society is going to work. You know, if we're all in it together, you know, we're just working class guys. We're going to be buddy buddy. You're just like me. Let's just go at it together. And it makes you want that to work. And that's why it was so effective. That's why like you see all these, it's kind of died down now. I think people have kind of wised up to it, but I remember back in like 2016, 2017 or so, I think Sargon used to make this point. I mean, he's kind of improved on the issue, but one thing that he would say is like, well, in the 90s, nobody even thought about race. Well, why can't we just go back to that during the Great Awakening, when all this stuff was turned up to 11? You know, if you actually look at the reality of the 1980s and 90s, I mean, in terms of something like black crime, it was actually even worse in America in the 80s and 90s than it is today. But the media that from that era was a lot more positive and kind of had a much better way of selling the idea of the American melting pot to the public and then to the rest of the world as well, for that matter. And that's why movies like this are actually kind of effective, because none of the stuff that's made today, I mean, I know it's kind of died down in the last year or two, but none of the stuff that was made in the 2010s or early 2020s, none of that makes me want multiculturalism. None of that makes me want it to work. It just makes me despise it even more. This stuff, it actually makes you think, oh, I you know, it could work, but then, you know, you look at the reality and it's not going to. But that's kind of why I think that movies like Trading Places were actually a lot more effective than the later stuff.
Yeah, especially because it doesn't even shy away altogether from the reality. Like that pub where Eddie Murphy walks in when he's newly rich, and he's got the butler outside, and he's got his suit on, like, it looks like such a sleazy dive. Like, it looks like you'll just get stabbed in the toilets. He's portrayed for the first sort of 20 minutes of the movie as just being this petty thief, lying little scumbag. You know, it's precisely because they've leaned into that the whole thing seems more realistic. It's as if they've taken the poison out of it. They're not shying away from it. I mean, on the other hand, I was on Frody's. I did a podcast with Frody yesterday, which was recorded, about Star Trek First Contact. And in that, they have like this, that was in 1996, and they have like this magical black woman in there who popped up on all these different things in the 1990s. And I don't know her name. And she's just there to be a black woman. Like, there's no other reason for it. Whereas here, they've at least kind of, well, explicitly in a hard way, when you get towards the two Dukes in the toilet scene at the end, which I think is interesting to get into a little bit more as well. That they've it's all acknowledged. They're not hiding away from this. Everything gets folded back in to a formula.
So that's where the potency of the subversion really lies. That they're actually honest about, you know, the street black, the guy who's the petty thief, that being Eddie Murphy's character. But then the kicker is that they're saying, and he's only like that because he's being discriminated against. So he's like, okay, we're acknowledging that he's like that, but then it's because of white racism. So that's kind of where the subversion really comes in. Because, I mean, the scene is funny. Like, it's a funny scene, but just how cartoonish it really is. That the idea is that there are these two guys who just absolutely love making money hand over fist, and they live for money. But they got this guy who's going to make them a ton of money, but they don't want him just because he's black, which is, I mean, it's a funny scene, but obviously it's ridiculous. But the thing is, though, this is the trope, which is, this is what liberals actually believe today. They actually believe that there's this grand conspiracy out there of white people to discriminate against black people just on a subconscious level. That this is what they, when they say institutional racism or white privilege or whatever, this is what they're talking about. It's supposed to be like this conspiracy theory that white people are just subconsciously conspiring against blacks to keep them down. It's ridiculous, but unfortunately, I mean, it's funny when it's presented in the movie like this, but this is like an idea which has caused enormous damage in the West today.
The bit after the Santa Claus scene, again, it's hilarious because of how sort of politically incorrect it is from today's perspective. Winthorpe is back in his townhouse and he thinks it's all been a bad dream. he thinks everything's he's been through for the last like few weeks or whatever has just been this horrible nightmare that he's had. But at the end of the bed, like, Eddie Murphy's sitting there, the Jamie Lee Curtis is there, and he's telling it to Coleman, the butler. And he says, I had this awful dream. I dreamt like I lost Penelope, I lost me money, I lost me house. I was with this sleazy prostitute, and this really irritating. And then he says a word that I can't say on YouTube. And then, of course, he sees him sitting there, and it's so shocking because it's so funny. But the point that I was making is, like, the fact that they use that language means that, yeah, they are racist. You know what I mean? They're not going to let the whites aren't race blind either. But as you were saying earlier, when you get to the end, the toilet scene at the end, it's where it's kind of like the rug is being pulled. If you had any illusions that they were actually, that this was a morality tale in a traditional sense, it's when you get to the end and basically the Randolph Mortimer, who set this up for a $1 bet, and they've kind of switched their positions on it, where the one who said that Eddie Murphy would succeed is turns on him, and the other one doesn't want Winthorpe back because he sees him as being a loser now. So they've completely changed, and it's suggested that they bring in Eddie Murphy, Billy Ray, because he's been earning them a lot of money. And you would think, like, you know, from the purely meritocratic capitalist sort of viewpoint, it wouldn't matter to them. But it turns out that it does, and that's when he calls them the hard N-word. We can't have one of those at Duke and Duke. So it's like, yeah, in the end, it is about white supremacy. It is about maintaining these racist institutions and structures and all the rest of it. That's hinted at as well earlier in another like funny line when Eddie Murphy's in the bath and he's singing. And Randolph says, they're very musical people, aren't they? when they first meet Eddie Murphy as well, they're talking to him like he's a four-year-old child. And they're like waving whiskey and money in his face and asking him to get into the car. I mean, yeah, it's crazy because it's not politically correct at all, this film, especially from today's standards. Yet it serves an even more subversive sort of it's more subversive for not being politically correct in this kind of weird way.
Yeah, because it's more effective for that reason. I mean, one thing I wanted to say about the time when this movie was made, so the 1980s, the Reagan era. I mean, one thing that stood out to me is that during this time period, the right was ostensibly all powerful in the United States. So Ronald Reagan nearly swept the Electoral College in 1980, then again in 1984. And then you look at a country like Britain, this was when Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister of Britain. And what we now call, like, I guess you'd call it the boomer right or the neoliberal right, the one that was in its heyday in the 1980s. While the right was so focused on winning these elections, what was the left doing? The left was churning out movies like this in Hollywood. They were in the universities, educating the younger generations. And when all was said and done, those huge electoral victories in 1980 and 1984 were much less effective than what the left was doing at the time, that being making Hollywood propaganda and brainwashing people in the universities, because eventually they changed the psychology of the population. I mean, this has already been underway by this point, but they eventually just changed the psychology of the population then later on, even people who are ostensibly on the right had adopted their ideas. And even someone like Ronald Reagan was an example of that. So by our standards today of what you might call the dissident right, the nationalist right, whatever you want to call it, the new right, Ronald Reagan was kind of a pushover. He was kind of what we'd call a cuck today. Like, he amnestied a huge amount of illegal immigrants in the U.S., which ensured states like California would be blue forever. He made MLK Day a national holiday in the United States. He wasn't quite as hardcore of a Zionist as the GOP became in the 2020s, but I mean, he was friendly towards that group. And he was really just right wing in the sense of economics, or at least that's the only real lasting impact he had. It was just kind of in the economic game. Whereas in the terms of things like demographics and culture and things like that, well, the left's so-called Long March to the Institution, that was just going full steam ahead throughout this decade. And I think what it drives home, like something like Trading Places, because you can see when something like this was made, you know, in the 2010s, when the people that saw this kind of movie when they were young were the politicians, well, they believe in all these tropes, like this ridiculous trope that there's just this great grand conspiracy of white privilege to just discriminate against black people or something like that. That was a much more effective strategy, that metapolitical strategy, than just being so focused on the election cycle. And I think that the right is finally starting to learn that in the past decade or so. And I don't know, I like to think that we're part of that, but this movie really drove that home for me, because you can see, well, who even though at the time the right was winning elections in landslides, well, who actually won in the long run? It was the people who played the long-term metapolitical game.
Yeah, this is like coming out at the peak of like Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and all eyes on economics, meritocracy, So it did lean into that as well. But, you know, and then especially the Cold War was still raging on. And all the while you had this kind of wriggling its way like an earworm into people's minds, precisely because it's so well done. It's so funny. This is the problem. It's like you have to see it is subversive, but it is also like a really fun film. There's no doubt about it. I mean, Kay Buckley just mentioned in the chat there the little scene where one of the Dukes tries to catch Eddie Murphy out, and he deliberately leaves like a roll of notes, his money on the floor, his money clip, thinking that Eddie Murphy will steal it, and of course he doesn't, because he's been in like the club for one day, and he's already decided, like, totally changed his ways. All of the, it's ridiculous when you think about it. That after one day, he's decided that he's not going to steal. He's going to be an honest broker, and all of the rest of it. So, yeah.
I mean, another thing to point out is that this is a movie about finance and investment. Isn't there a group that's missing that is not portrayed? Because I mean, they go really hard on the WASP aesthetic with the Duke and Duke brothers with their Heritage Club and their 1776 founded. Isn't there a group missing, like, who you'd expect to be in finance, like when they go to the New York Stock Exchange? Nowhere in the movie, but, you know, they're behind the camera, though.
I, you know, where you do see one who would pass for one of that group is at the end when they're in the trading pit and the two Dukes send somebody down who looks very Semitic. And he goes down, I think he's called Wilson or something, and they tell him to go down and no matter what happens, don't sell, because they think they have the report, but it's a fake. So they bet everything they've got on the orange juice harvest being damaged by bad weather. So they're going to kind of rig it like that. And he's the most of that group in the movie. It's amazing. Like, their absence here is absolutely amazing when you think of it. And the one who is like a minion of the Dukes that we didn't see until that point. I mean, another minion that we got was Clarence Beeks as well, who I just think, just to sort of say that he's an amazing character, just this pure bastard of a man. And I remember when I was a kid and I would watch this, and I always loved the scene where he gets onto the telephone and there's like a woman standing waiting for him, and he's trying to have a conversation about what's happening with the Orange reports or whatever it is. And there's this, like, just like this normal pretty woman standing behind him, and he just puts the phone like to one side, turns around, and just tells, he just like, fuck off. And then you see him walking along the platform at the train station, and he's just barging through people and throwing them out of the way. It's I just every time he came on, I thought it was hilarious. I mean, I thought the gorilla bit at the end that they played, I could see that joke coming a mile away. But yeah, so many great characters. The other character in it was Denham Elliott, which we haven't mentioned much. And this was another thing in the 1980s that they did quite a lot, where it was a sign of like extreme high status to have an English butler. You know, people will probably recognize Denham Elliott from Indiana Jones, and he's in that as well. And his role in the scheme is kind of strange, because it's so cold-hearted. When everything turns to shit for Winthorpe, he goes along with it, like happily goes along with it at the behest of the two Dukes. And when Winthorpe turns up at the door, he just stands there and looks in his eyes and pretends that he just doesn't know who he is at all. But then later, I think this is maybe the only kind of writing kind of wonky thing in it, because later he like totally joins up the coalition of the kind of dispossessed to get back at the Dukes, the coalition of the outcasts and the weirdos, But yeah, so but again, great character actor, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually kind of confused in the scene that he didn't know who Dan Aykroyd's character was. It took me a while to figure out that he was actually like he was paid by the Dukes to just pretend like he didn't even know who Winthorpe was. It was funny. Definitely a funny scene, and that is a trope you see a lot in a lot of these movies, like kind of the butler who's really stiff upper lip, but also kind of clumsy at the same time. It's a funny 1980s trope.
And the one where the Dukes have got their own servant, but he's black, and he says, "What is it?" He gives them like ten. Is it $10? Or he gives them $5. And he says, "This is your Christmas bonus for this year." And he gives him $5, and he thinks, "Oh, thanks. I think I'll go to the cinema alone." But then the other brother, so you've got like the joke there, but then they double it up because the other brother says, "Well, half of it's from me." it's just such good writing, because you get like the setup, then you get the payoff, and then you kind of get an extra payoff on top of that you didn't see coming. Class writing. So yeah, like, it's Trading Places. Is it subversive? Yes. Is it funny? Yes. It's unfortunately a lot of the other 80s comedies, they were really at the top of their game, like really at the top of their game. And yeah, I think it began to go all to hell in the 90s, and now everybody just hates movies now.
Oh, I think that the 80s had the best comedies, especially the American ones. Like, this one's really good. I think some of my favorite comedies would probably be Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Weekend at Bernie's, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Just fantastic comedy, and they still hold up today. One thing I like is that they don't require all these like pop cultural references and meta jokes and things like that. I like that it's just kind of funny and timeless in its own right. So yeah, great writing back then. At least in my opinion, the best comedies were from this time period.
Yeah, I mean, there's no references to pop culture. I mean, I mentioned the Vietnam one earlier, but that's not really related to other movies. You've got when Eddie Murphy did like a sort of Bruce Lee impression when he was in the jail. But again, like, you know,
that still works though.
Yeah, it still works. It's in world. So you get immersed in the world. It's not this like endless pastiche of these other films and all of that. So, you know, you're all right though. I mean, at the end of it all, you know, they just head off to a tropical island to live the high life. I'm surprised they never made a sequel, to be honest. Somebody in the chat says, in a few years later, Eddie Murphy made another comedy where he was an African and he was coming to America, called Coming to America. And somebody said that the two Dukes have a cameo in that, and they're on the street as these like sort of bums, these washed up bums on the street, which is a nice little nod and a wink. But yeah, Trading Places, good, it's good crack. Like, there's a lot to get into with some of these films.
Yeah, it's definitely a funny movie. I know we got into the heavy political stuff, but I mean, as long as you know that that's there, there's nothing wrong with enjoying the movie. So I don't mean to tell people that, like, you know, don't mean to tell people that this is a great comedy movie and you're bad if you enjoy it. But I mean, it's there, but it is what it is.
I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about that outside influence and WASP America and everything, but it still comes across as less blatantly anti-white than I thought when I put it into the full. I can see that there's a few excuses for it. I think all in all, you've got the main villains are the WASPs, though. I don't think there's any getting around with it, but it does sort of play into the racial stuff as well in the prisons and that. I think the his fiancee Penelope and their little gang at the like the squash club or whatever it was, like, they just come out of this looking like absolute scumbags. They really do. They look, you just don't want to be around them. They're so pretentious and
Yeah, you can tell like the Squash Club looks like it's from the Great Gatsby, and it says like or that Wenthorpe says that he has a tie from Harvard, and it, I mean they really go hard on a lot of that stuff. And I mean it does, it's effective at making them look snobbish and everything, which I guess that's the idea.
I mean, I was thinking because I was reading up a little bit of The Prince and the Pauper, and I was thinking of there was another Mark Twain book. This would be like the kind of classic movies that you do, but I'm going to do it for my turn on which will be like January or February. Where there was an old movie with Gregory Peck called The £1 Million Note. And it's where he's given £1 million, a banknote of £1 million, and he can't cash it anywhere. I haven't seen it since I was a kid. And he basically racks everything up on debt, but he can't actually do anything with the note, but he's able to get lots of it. So I think that would be good. I think that would be a good one to get into for my, but I'll have to wait for a month or two. I'm pretty much out of takes on Trading Places, like, unless you've got any more, but I think we'll
I think we got it.
The idea of money and the sort of follow on from this, I think that £1 million note would be a good one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I've never seen that one, so I've got
Everlast sunglasses. Thanks for everything you do, Morgoth. Or a coffee there. Well, all right. Thanks a lot. I don't think I did get a lovely $50 super sticker off Dawn Browning as well. So thank you very much for that, Dawn, long-time fan of the channel. And I think that's about it. Got Closeton in the chat there. I saw EA popped up as well. And then it's the regulars. So what do you fancy doing next month? Are you doing one for me? Oh, we'll have to be careful because it's Christmas, but we'll see.
I was wondering if we should do something Christmas related. I don't know if I really have any ideas. Yeah, that's why I thought, like, I don't know if I have any ideas of anything Christmas related, so it might get us out of that. So
wait a second there. Arclorox, not sure if you did it already, but would you guys consider Rosemary's Baby? I think I might, but that's a Polanski film, isn't it? And I don't want to have to go through a ton of justifications about why I'm kind of discussing, you know what I mean?
Well, I think you can do a Polanski movie without talking about him, Polanski himself, can't you?
I mean, I love Chinatown as well. I'd prefer Chinatown, but you just get that kind of bad vibe. Is that gonna, is him being like what he is gonna overshadow everything? We'll see. I'm not gonna say no. We'll see.
I'm not against doing one of his movies because I think you can separate the film from the guy who made it. But I don't know. I haven't really thought. I have a couple of ideas, but since I guess we did one Christmas related, I guess we don't need to do that next month. But we'll announce that. We'll announce it down the road.
All right. So I think I think Chinatown's great as well. So, all right. I tell you, for subscribers on the Substack, I'll usually do a little monthly podcast where I go through the articles. I've done quite a few off-platform appearances, so I'm maybe a day or two late, because then I'll do me monthly read-through of me articles, and I'll give a few takes on the news and whatnot. But then I've got like three podcasts or something there that I've got to assemble and get it all together. I've been doing a rare tour. I've been e-celebing a little bit again after I just blog for months, and then it's always around this time of year I seem to do loads of podcasts and streams and whatnot. So I'm going to cobble all of that together in the and try and get up the next day or two. So thanks for tuning in, everybody, and I'll catch you later.